So thank you very much and welcome to another masterclass for Enable IQ. And I'd like to introduce our very, very special guest, Stella Cho from Citi.
Hi, Johnny. How are you?
Really good. Thank you so much for joining us. And I might start by a really simple question. Stella, can you tell us a bit about what you do for a living?
Sure. I am currently the corporate banking head for Australia and New Zealand at Citi, responsible for covering all of our institutional client relationships across both countries. So a lot of our clients are the big, large corporates that we all know and love, all of the big financial institutions that we can transact a lot of our personal business as well as our corporate business. We support a lot of the public sector as well, so federal as well as state government institutions, and of course our global subsidiaries team, which supports all the multinational relationships that we have around the world, where they have significant operations across Australia and New Zealand.
So it's a pretty broad role and you look after a broad range of stakeholders and customers. And that's something we've obviously worked together before. And I thought that's one of the biggest challenges of a role like yours. But I believe that you've got a new role. So that's not true for too long, this particular role. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Yep. So I've recently been appointed the Asia Pacific head for the Global Subsidiaries Group. So responsible for all of our multinational corporate relationships across Asia Pacific. So that's very exciting. So that's actually kicked off. So I'm currently double hatting.
Oh, two jobs.
Two jobs for the price of one.
Beautiful. All right. Well, that sounds nice and easy for you to be able to manage. So probably even more so, I want to say thank you for the time that you've put aside for us. And I suppose with the masterclasses, we're looking for experts in their field to share some of their story about how they learnt what they learnt, how they became masters in their class, so to speak. And there's a couple of areas I wanted to touch on today. And so number one was around leadership. That's something that I've mentioned to you before that I've really noticed around being able to bring people through the organization, your focus on all kinds of diversity within your organization and your teams, but also the accountability and I'll call it positive pressure that you put on some of the juniors to come through the business. And then the second is you are still in a sales role and a pitching role. And obviously that's what Enable IQ and Enable SE looks at and talks to every day. So I'd love to explore some of that as well, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. That sounds great.
So why don't we start with where it all began and tell us a bit about how you got into the industry?
Sure. Look, I actually had never intended to go into banking and finance. It's not something I'd thought about when I was younger. I always thought I'd go into more public policy, humanitarian affairs, and had started out my career at the UN for working at an UN organization in Geneva, for another international organization in Brussels, mostly focused on migration and refugee issues. But I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and the Wharton Business School is the business school attached to that university. So there are a lot of very close contacts into the large corporates, into the banks, consulting firms. And through that network, I had an opportunity to start out at Old Chase in their analyst training program. And I thought, well, this is actually a great opportunity for me to get a couple of years experience on the finance side, which I thought is an important element to anything, any kind of position that you have in the future. In the meantime, also think about where I want to really focus my energies, whether it was going to be around poverty or women's issues. But I started out in high yield bond origination in New York in the late 90s. And it was a super exciting time in that product area. And we were just going absolute gangbusters. And so we're working around the clock. There wasn't really time to think about anything else. Soon I found myself on a plane to London to help them build out the corporate high yield business. And was really just on this career path. So that's kind of how I started in banking. And then kind of halfway through, I decided to take a sabbatical and went to go volunteer with UNICEF in their Asia Pacific regional headquarters in Bangkok at the time. And it was during that time, I was able to kind of reconcile my desire to kind of help communities and societies, but at the same time, kind of continue to develop myself and network and build my own skill set. And so ended up coming back into banking with a view to potentially doing something more later on.
Right. So humanitarian was the focus originally, and then we've lost another humanitarian to banking from there. But you sort of mentioned you got into it quite quickly and it was moving so quickly you couldn't think. What was it about it that really drew you in?
You know, it's a really fast-paced environment, and it's one where, you know, people need to come up the curve very quickly. You kind of have to figure things out. You know, you need to, you know, keep on learning, stepping up your own knowledge base and skill base in a short amount of time. It's also, you know, where a lot of bright people kind of converge. So, you know, being able to work with, you know, some of the best and brightest was super exciting. And the other element that I really enjoy was the fact that it's very much a meritocracy. I think out of all the industries out there, this is probably one of the most meritocratic industries where, you know, what you produce and what you're able to contribute is pretty black and white. And I think that's something where it doesn't really matter where you're from, who you are, what you look like, you know, what you've been able to produce and contribute is something that, you know, is recognized and acknowledged.
It's an interesting point, isn't it? Because one of the things I love about sales and pitching is you either win it or you don't. And it's a bit tongue in cheek, but we often talk about that if six companies are pitching for a major pitch, one wins and five come second. Because so often we hear this and say, look, we didn't win it, but we were really close. And we almost got there. It was just one or two key things there. Whereas whether you're close or not, it's the exact same result, isn't it? You get nothing out of it. And I think it's that idea of you know, being black and white allows high performers to, they love that. They love the idea that you either get rewarded or you don't. You win, you don't. And it's interesting to hear that that's one of the things that drew you to it, which probably explains why you're a high performer. Tell me, you said you took some time out to work at UNICEF in Bangkok, and I'm not sure how long you spent there, but I'm really curious about what did you learn from a lessons perspective, whether it's through leadership, whether it be through, you know, work ethic, whether it be around, you know, communication. I'm really keen to know what are some of those lessons that have driven you to where you are now?
Yeah, I think at UNICEF, it was very much about collaboration. You've got all of these different program teams, whether it's, you know, water and sanitation, education, nutrition, and they're very focused on those particular topics and those particular areas, you know, in terms of really being able to contribute and help children around the world. And so where I was working, which was essentially to help build partnerships with multinationals across Asia Pacific, really working with those program officers and program teams to determine, you know, how to be able to best collaborate with that particular company that wanted to partner with UNICEF. You know, it just meant that I had to learn a lot about those different programs and then work with each of those programs with the client and act as that bridge to bring them together. And, you know, that's kind of what, you know, happens in so many industries, and it happens in finance as well and banking, where, you know, we've got so many different product areas, we've got so many different clients, and pulling it all together and, you know, acting as that bridge to be able to connect and be able to make sure that we can help you know, the program team as well as the clients. You know, that's something that was actually a great learning for me.
Yeah, interesting. I had it described once as you're almost the facilitator. You're facilitating the different, whether it be products, the different teams, to be able to get the best result. And it comes down to how well you can conduct or facilitate those teams on whether you get the end result or not.
Yeah, and a lot of it has to do with communication, right? So, you know, an organization like UNICEF is very much focused on the sustainability aspect to it, the long-term impact, you know, the kind of the, it's not necessarily just quantifiable impact. And, you know, for clearly a lot of the companies that want to partner and give, you know, they want to see what the quantifiable impact is. You know, how many schools am I going to be building? How many children am I going to be affecting and in a positive way? And so, you know, kind of being able to kind of build that communication across those different kind of languages is pretty important. It's the same with, you know, same in banking.
I think it takes me back to the first time I met you. We were running a session with a lot of the MDs from your bank across Australia and New Zealand. And we talked about that idea of getting to the outcome, getting to what the customer wants or the client gets out of this. And we work with a couple of not-for-profits that we've supported. And like corporates, they get very good at talking about what they do as opposed to the outcome that you achieve. And I think in the not-for-profits, one of the things we've learned a lot is getting them to communicate to the outcome, because there's such a human outcome and such a broad outcome when it comes to humans as well. And whilst banking can be seen as, in some cases, drier or cleaner, there are genuine outcomes for individuals who work for these organizations, their customers and their clients. And it's how do we articulate that? How do we get it? And how do we do it in 30 seconds or 10 seconds? How do we do it quickly? Which is always the biggest challenge.
Yeah, and Johnny, I have to say, you did an amazing session for our team at Citi in Australia. I mean, I think all the MDs raved about what you were able to bring to us, and really gave us a much clearer, you know, picture and understanding of, you know, where we could improve our own pitching skills. And then I brought you back to kind of do a session with my team more broadly. And again, I think some of the guys did, you know, that was the best thing that they've ever done at Citi. So thank you so much for that.
Stop it, Stella. I can't take it anymore. But no, it is, we love what we do, and hopefully it comes across when we talk to it. But we work across so many products and so many organizations and style of organizations, and our expertise is the pitching. It's not the product. And sometimes I think when you're an expert in something, you get caught up in that detail. And so we've got fund managers who we work globally with, because we speak to their message clearer than they speak to the message, because they know every stock. They know every currency, they know every detail and the work that goes into it, but the end buyer isn't interested in that. That might be due diligence later, but that's not what engages them. And I think that when we get to that point, and almost the bigger the organization or the bigger the not-for-profit, the more of the story that we want to tell. You know, 20 minutes in, we're still telling the story of the organization. You know, back in 1956, when we founded this part of it, but what do we get out of it today? And so I think that's really important. And I know that's something that you took on a leadership role, even within the leaders around that, because you were able to talk to, you actually used live examples for your business and your clients on how you can get, you know, a better message and a clearer message across, which was good to see from my perspective.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I think your training was super compelling for all of us. You know, I think you're absolutely right. It's so easy for us to just get into our own messaging, our own story, you know, what we do at Citi, you know, who we are, and not necessarily translate that to why that matters for the client, right? We talk about client centricity internally all the time, but really getting into that client mindset it can be very challenging.
Yeah. I don't want to keep harping on this, but I do remember running an internal strategy session, and we looked at who are the key stakeholders with this particular product we were launching. And I think the customer came up 13th, wasn't within your organization, but one of their values was customer centricity, but they didn't come up as a stakeholder. And I think it's so easy to forget that, because we're so busy and we're so focused on so many things, but it just comes back to these fundamentals, doesn't it? Who's the customer? What are they doing? What are they thinking? What are they feeling? And how do we drive that better, so to speak?
Absolutely. Understanding all of that, but also kind of trying to figure out how what you're offering, you know, matters to them, right? And being able to communicate it in a really simple, clear, articulate, you know, compelling way. And I think that's something that you really helped us achieve.
Oh, I could literally spend hours talking about this, but it is one more thing you've just pointed on, that is that idea of what matters to them, and then how does our offering match that? And it's that idea of, we spent a lot of time talking about stakeholder analysis and questioning to uncover their drivers, like what really drives them. And then we talk about how does your product match? And one of the missing links we see often is that we get good at questioning and good at stakeholder analysis, and then we just offer the same thing we would have offered anyone. And we use our language and our words, and it doesn't resonate because it's not what's important to them. So it almost says to them, you're not listening. Even though the offering could be the same, it's just relating it back to that. So I'll keep moving on. I'm really curious for you is, what was an influencer for you in your career? Was it a person, or was it people? Was it some training that you did? Was it, you know, what was it to you that influenced you to get to where you are today?
Oh, you know, I have to say it's probably kind of the, my sponsors, you know, some of my bosses that I had over the years. I've had some incredible, incredible bosses who've really helped me just increase my, increase my kind of networking, open doors for me, introduce me to, you know, to other people, and really kind of helped, you know, advocate for me, across across the business and up to kind of senior management. And that's, that was incredibly helpful. That really kind of also gave me the confidence to be able to keep pushing forward, knowing that I had, great sponsorship and great advocates behind me. I'm a big believer in, having, kind of a board of directors, if you will. So, it's kind of over time, over many years of a career, you kind of, connect with people, over those many years of working. And, they may not be people that are formally, you know, mentoring you or sponsoring you. They're just, you know, maybe a boss that you had that you really, you know, you really enjoyed working with. And, you know, they're people that you just stay in touch with, you know, people that you can bounce ideas off of at a later time. So yeah, over the years, I've developed a really good group of friendships with a number of people like this, where, you know, even if a year or two goes by and I haven't, you know, we haven't spoken, I can still, you know, call on them and, you know, bounce ideas, you know, and ask them for their thoughts, you know, ask them for an introduction or opening doors. And that's really been incredibly critical to my progression.
It's good to hear. I had a cup of coffee in the office of a quite influential CEO. So he's influential in both the public sector as well as private sector, very well known. And he met with me because I cold emailed him off an article that was in the AFR and asked if we could continue this conversation. And it was around leadership and mentoring. And he told me that he has half a dozen mentors, and that the range of informal and formal, and he'd go to different mentors depending on what he wanted or needed at the time. And I really took that on, and I've probably got, I think, five mentors that I would call that. And some of them are friends as well as mentors. Some of them I would only call on if there was something quite formal to discuss and that was worth their time as well as mine. But I'd get different things from different people. And I think the more you can get that, you don't need a mentor to do all of it for you. Plus, we've got to trust ourselves, don't we? We've got to think that we're pretty good at what we do. And it's that addition, or it's the challenge that we have. It's that ability to, you know, I'm a pretty headstrong, confident person. So I often go to mentors to actually push back and challenge me to understand, do I really believe it? And I think that's great to hear that you've had multiple. Can I ask this idea of, were you a bit of a natural early, or is this something that took a while to click? And if so, what was the moment that it really clicked for you?
Yeah, look, I mean, I've always, enjoyed meeting people, developing relationships. I think I've just been, you know, very fortunate to have some really inspired leaders, that I've been able to work with. And, you know, that's not necessarily true for a lot of people, but I've been pretty lucky. And so those people I've really, cultivated that relationship with. And I think for me, developing those relationships and having those interpersonal skills, you know, I've had, from early on. But I think the kind of the leadership aspect, certainly that's taken a lot of hard work. And that's taken a lot of, kind of experiences, a lot of, failures and learnings along the way. And it's kind of a continuous journey. It's, nobody's perfect. And there's always things that are constantly changing and evolving. I think I would say that very early on, my, leadership style was very much involved a lot of micromanagement, which can be incredibly difficult for lots of people around you. I've had to evolve that over time, with, bigger teams and, different circumstances. It's just been, you can't kind of do, lead that way anymore. And then I think that you have to continuously challenge yourself, because the world is changing. I think 20, 25 years ago, people were working, 120 hours a week, and pulling all nighters, you're working 7 days a week. And that was just the accepted, kind of practice. And there was a lot of shouting in the office and swearing and, all of those type of things. Today's environment is very different. I think people, young people don't come into the workforce thinking that, or expecting to be shouted at, or, be pulling all nighters. There's a sense of, I want to be treated, well, I want to have some work-life balance. I want to be a well-rounded individual. I need training. I need support. So it's a different environment altogether. And I think, we need to kind of evolve as leaders to be able to lead, as the entire world progresses as well. So, it's a constant challenge for myself to kind of, kind of rethink, old values or old beliefs, and be able to, continue to update them over time and really try and progress as the world evolves.
I like that idea of being able to lead through change. And I think it's what the best leaders do. I think when things are constant, you can just get into a process, right? You can get into an operating rhythm, and that can be quite easy. But when the world changes like it has, and I've certainly seen some of the best leadership of my life in the last 2 years, but I've also seen some of the most challenged leadership of my life from people where they haven't been able to lead through the change. It's really hit them themselves and then struggle to drive it forward. You have this, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe curiosity. Like, I know Brené Brown talks about that idea of being a curious leader. And we think in sales and pitching, it's curiosity is a really big trait. And that's something for me that's always come across for you. Is that a natural curiosity for you, or is that something you push yourself on?
Yeah, no, I'm naturally pretty curious. You know, I think that's always been important in my in just my development in my field. You know, I've had to be curious about, you know, all of the different things that, you know, kind of unfold, whether it's with a client or whether new products, you know, what we're able to offer, you know, the changing landscape that's, you know, that's that we need to kind of, you know, stay on top of. So yeah, I'm naturally curious to learn more about everything. So I tend to ask lots of questions. And I love the nature of my job because it is so varied. You know, I can get involved with clients from all different industries, whether it's, you know, media, technology, healthcare, metals and mining, resources, all the way through to looking at different kinds of products, whether it's ESG linked, you know, sustainability linked financings, or whether it's, you know, commodity hedging, looking at, you know, geopolitical issues and how that's impacting a lot of our clients, cybersecurity, which is, you know, which is also a massive topic. So, you know, I have a natural curiosity to learn about all of these areas and go deeper and wider. And you know, I think that's been important for me. And I think also from a leadership perspective, I'm really curious about people. You know, I really feel like there's something to learn from every single interaction, every single person that you meet. And yeah, so I think that, you know, for me, that's been quite fun.
I do find that some of the best leaders and the best salespeople are curious, and maybe that's why we get on so well, because I often want to know things. I want to understand, why is that the case? And so I listen to a lot of podcasts while I'm exercising. And not only do I just listen to it, I then have to Google it and search it. I send myself emails throughout the podcast to make sure I'm questioning, and how do I use it with what we're doing? So I think that's a really good trait to have. I want to come back to this idea of leadership, and you've got this drive to have diversity in your team. And I think diversity often comes across as, you know, in one way we want to be diverse, but you've really hit that idea of being diverse in many. I might start with that and tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, diversity is so incredibly important. You know, I think a lot of our, when we think about our, you know, the world that we live in, and, you know, the clients that we're servicing, you know, at Citi, it's so diverse, and clients are increasingly becoming more and more global as well. And, you know, our kind of way of thinking has to reflect that. And, you know, I think we need to challenge ourselves to have a broader, more creative way of thinking. That's what's happening right now. If you think about all of the digital enhancements, innovation, all the pioneering strategies, the different ways that, you know, our clients are connecting with their own customers or their suppliers, it's all changing at a rapid pace, which means that we need a lot more creativity within our own teams to be able to, you know, provide solutions for those clients. So having more diversity is going to increase that kind of creativity. And so, you know, for me, it's not just about, you know, gender diversity. It's about having people from, you know, different kind of age groups, to kind of having generational, business, a team that kind of spans different generations, but also, you know, having people from different walks of life, different backgrounds. You know, it's just important to have that. So I think the team that, you know, I've got here is, you know, they've got people from, you know, from Ireland, from Italy, from Argentina, from Brazil, from Singapore, from Malaysia, and from all walks of life as well. People who didn't necessarily start out from banking, you know, they came in with a completely different backgrounds, degrees. And I think that's really helped us produce an incredibly strong team of people who are supporting clients incredibly successfully.
I think it's a really brave thing to do as well. I think to just hire the same people from the same group and the same pool, you're going to get a really similar result. And there's such a fight for that talent, it just ends up with, we just have to pay more. Or do we try and sell our culture to them? You know, and it ends up with a race to the bottom in some degree, because there's only so much talent there. One of our clients took the brave step recently of for just a 6-month period, only hired from outside the industry, because when we looked at the industry, we thought, we think we've got the best talent. So if we want the best, we have to go outside of it. And so I think from that perspective, it's brave, but it also makes sense to have different people challenging you and different people thinking about it. I know that when we work on these major pitches or a trade sale, I don't know anything about this particular mining business and what it is that they're mining, but that's not my job. My job is to get them to be able to position it effectively to potential buyers. And so we ask different questions, but I also know that when I work with different organizations, and yours was a great example of that, I'm learning all the time, because I'm learning from a different way of thinking. We attack problems from different areas. So I think that's really clear from working with your team around that idea of diversity. I want to get a bit more practical here. And you did something before our last team session. I think you would have had 45 or maybe 40 odd people that were on that session. And before I sort of give the result of it and the outcome from a facilitator's perspective, how did you prep and prime your team leading up to that session?
Well, I just said that, you know, you had done an incredible session with the MDs in the business. And, you know, that, you know, while everyone does an incredible job of, you know, building their relationships and servicing their clients, you know, we can probably do a better, you know, better job of communicating. And you are the communications expert. So I asked everyone to kind of be prepared to, you know, kind of learn and take in what, you know, what you can, you know, what you had to say.
Did you give any specific prep work or any specific instructions to different members of the team or different groups of the team?
No, I didn't. I pretty much, you know, kind of let it flow. I mean, the team has been working together for, you know, quite a long time. Yeah. And they're a pretty cohesive unit. They're also a very open-minded group. And so, you know, wanted to kind of, you know, have a fairly clean slate for you to come and, you know, deliver your ideas and your thought. And I love the fact that we kind of had these breakout rooms where people could actually, you know, put it into practice. And I think people found that to be really useful versus just having someone, you know, just a monologue training session, which I tend to find not particularly productive.
Yeah, no one wants to hear me speak for 4 hours straight, I can promise you that. What blew me away, and this is the impact, I suppose, from whatever the words that you did say, is that within the first 30 minutes, every single member of your team had volunteered to get involved in some way. And I've never seen that before in such a short space of time. So some of your, you know, managing directors, you know, the leaders within the team were getting very involved, but some of the more junior members of the team, so those that have, you know, clearly newer in the business, had the confidence to put their hand up, to challenge and to have a go, to try. And I think that's that psyche of, if you want to do better and get better, you have to put yourself out there. You have to get uncomfortable. And I noticed that within the team. And it's probably what drew me to you and your leadership so quickly and so strongly, is they had the confidence to be able to go and do that. So I suppose a question for you is, how have you been able to foster that confidence within your team?
Yeah, look, I want everyone to have a voice, and, you know, certainly in a safe environment, like, you know, when it's just within our team or it's a team meeting, I want people to feel like, you know, they should have the confidence to speak up, right? This isn't like a massive forum with, you know, lots of other people from the public or whatnot. So typically when we have, you know, our team meetings, you know, I will just call on people. So, you know, the expectation is that your video is on. So yeah, people's videos off, typically they'll, you know, say I'm driving somewhere or, you know, they're not feeling well or whatnot. But typically, you know, most people's or almost everyone's video is on. And people know that I will just call on people and, you know, ask people to, you know, mention what their observation is, or if they had a question, or, you know, speak about a particular topic that, you know, I know that they're, you know, heavily involved in, or maybe it's a particular transaction that they worked on. And so I want everyone to feel like they're involved and engaged. And someone actually noted that I tend to call on people whose videos might be off.
As do I. Yep.
So I think, but I want people to realize, and like, I think the more practice people have, you know, the more comfortable they feel to, you know, to speak and participate. And then I think, you know, particularly with, you know, maybe some of the quieter juniors, you know, I will send them a text message if I have a guest speaker and say, hey, haven't heard your question yet, you know, looking forward to hearing your, you know, your observations or your sharing. And so, you know, I will kind of, you know, make, you know, put a little bit of pressure on people to get involved. I mean, frankly, it also staves off boredom, right? You know, how many like boring meetings, not your session, of course, but, you know, other meetings that we're in all day long. And, you know, it's very easy to tune out, but, you know, if you know that you have to, you know, be engaged and you need to, you know, kind of contribute in that way, you know, people tend to be, you know, more thoughtful. They tend to be, you know, they're not asleep. So.
Well, I think when you're running training sessions, you almost want, when they're online, to be as though you're sitting in a boardroom or a conference room. Yeah, that level of accountability to it. And the reason I make the point is that was a Friday session and it was 4 hours with 40 people. So there's a real risk when it comes to that of people switching off. and they could sit back and let it happen for them. And that wasn't the case. And so for me, the 4 hours just flew by.
Well, I think it flew by for my team too. I mean, it was no work on their part to be engaged. Actually, you did an incredible job of being really, really relevant, really compelling, that I think people wanted to, also engage with you and, your team and get feedback on what they were thinking. Were they thinking about it in the right way? How could they kind of pivot, kind of how they were presenting something, a particular topic, and, get your views. I think, you created that, that atmosphere very, very quickly.
Well, I appreciate that. And I do think, though, it says a lot about the group itself. And obviously, I like what I do. But there's days like that where it feels effortless because of the group being so engaged. And I get to talk about a topic that I'm excited and interested in. And it means we get to apply it and relate it back to things that are live, which, again, makes it more interesting. The reverse of that, though, is I had a session the day before, and it was quite a big training session for the group. And out of the 12 people that were there, six of them were from their car and one was from a cafe. And they said, oh, I hope that's okay. And I said, well, but why are you out when we've got training? Like, it's in your diary. We should be there focused on this. And it was a really challenging piece. And of course, I'm getting paid to do what I do, but I love what I do and I want to get outcomes. And I didn't feel as though I could get the outcome from where we were sitting at the time. So I asked if we could move the session. They said, no, let's keep it going because it's in the diary. But it felt like we were getting 20% of the value of what we could have had if we were just there focused and sharing for each other. And I felt for the five that were sitting in their homes, focused on a camera, because they were there ready to learn and the others weren't. And I think that comes down to, one, individual accountability. Now, what role do I play when I'm sitting in something to do with training? But also from a leadership perspective, I think that they weren't driven. And I get the impression that that wouldn't have been okay if half your team was, on the road sitting on their telephone, at a cafe or a bar or something like that.
No, not so much.
I want to ask you this around...
Unless you're with a client.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I want to ask you about your career. And obviously you've worked in a number of different countries. I say obviously, but maybe others don't know. We've obviously heard the States, we've heard Bangkok, we've heard London, and obviously me here, you're in Australia. But I want to know, was there ever a fork in the road? Was there ever, a defining moment in your career where you could have chosen one way or the other and you decided to follow the path you're on now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was probably when I went and took that sabbatical and volunteered with UNICEF. I actually thought that was going to be my path kind of back into the international organizations and humanitarian work. And it was over that course of that year that, the head of UNICEF at the time was a former banker, long-term banker. And, once she'd finished her banking career, she had this incredible skill set, this incredible network. And then she was appointed the director general of UNICEF, and she was able to go in and make lots of waves and a significant impact. And, I thought, I think that's probably going to be more of my path. And that was a real kind of defining moment for me in terms of which path I went, from that point onwards. And, a lot of people in financial services, they have a career for a long time, but, you can almost have a second life. And, a lot of people in financial services will go and want to make a contribution and give back. And so I think, that's kind of how I felt that I would kind of take the course of my life and my career. So I went back into banking and, I missed it. I missed the fast pace. I missed, the kind of drive and the energy and the adrenaline that comes with, doing some of the, big transactions with, some of the most iconic clients out there. I came back for that.
Okay. I'll keep moving with that. And obviously you like fast paced because you're doing two jobs at once at the moment. So, and I know the other context of obviously moving and things like that. So you've got a lot on your plate at the moment. So again, I'm mindful of time, but thinking about doing these transactions with some of the world's most iconic companies, if you could sit down and talk to a group of people around, for lack of a better term, sales or pitching, what are some parameters? What are some rules? What are some, tips that you'd provide around what really works in a high-performing environment when it comes to selling and pitching?
Look, I think number one, you have to know your client. You really need to know your client inside out, you know, really what their concerns are, what they're good at, what they're, you know, finding trouble with. You want to know everything that you can. You want to also know what the key individuals in those organizations, those key decision makers, you know, what's driving them? You know, what are they trying to achieve, and how can we help them achieve those goals? I think that's got to be number one. We need to really know our client well and not make assumptions. We should be in a position to and hopefully ask very direct questions. I tried to tell my team that we run a very transparent, very open relationship with our clients. So it's very much direct conversations, open transparency, and I think that communication is really important to knowing more about the client and also being able to service their needs as the best that we can.
I know a lady who's a really high performing salesperson that I work with, and we're doing a stakeholder analysis. And I said, so who knows what about this? And there was a couple of things we didn't know. And they said, can we go and contact them? Can we get in touch? She said, no, on a Wednesday, she goes and does this with her son. So don't call her then. And Thursday morning has Pilates. And then so after 9 o'clock is the best time to catch them. But if you text her beforehand and say you're going to call, and I just thought, wow, that's knowledge of a client. It's not just about their day-to-day decision-making. It's about what drives them and that individual. And I think sometimes in major transaction, what's lost is it's individuals that make the decision. It's still people who have kids, their job, problems that are having, they're busy, they've got a lot on. So it's not always a fully framed decision-making process. Sometimes there is gut involved, there is emotion involved. And if someone cares enough to know your diary and know your schedule, they're probably someone you want to work with over the long term as well. And so I think that knowing your client, it's every fundamentals we talk about is be great at questioning, be curious, find out more, ask more questions, but go deeper rather than just more questions, ask deeper questions. And I think that's it's good to hear that even in the style of transactions you're doing, it's still just as critical.
Yeah, I mean, this is, 100% a people business, right? So it's, we're dealing with individuals. We're not just dealing with a corporate, it's not just a box. We're dealing with human beings. And, I think it's, I think that's become even more, if it wasn't obvious to everyone already, it's even more obvious over the past couple of years with the pandemic. I think COVID's had a huge impact on everyone. It's a globally shared experience, and it's touched every single person in some way. And, it's hard to know what's going on in everyone's lives, right? But, you kind of have to have some empathy that people have been touched in a certain way by this pandemic. And, in a lot of ways, you see more of it because, everyone's been working from home. You see their kids running around the background. You see the doorbell going off. You see, all of these things happening, or, people are driving somewhere because, they couldn't get help or whatever it was. And so, all of these things are going on. So we see more into people's lives, whether it's our own, our own team members, whether it's, our clients. And so I think everyone's kind of a bit more humanized than they were before.
I certainly know a lot more about how strong my clients and team's kids are at maths and English after the years of homeschooling as well. So, and there's certain year three and four maths that I've now done for some of my team's kids as well. And, certainly it's a strength of mine. Stella, if you ever need a hand, please let me know. But being in their world, we often tell our clients this when we're doing training and facilitating, is it's a real privilege that you're being invited into that person's world. You're in their home. That's a different world to what we're used to,
Absolutely.
And so you've got to, one, respect it, but two, just to, understand that idea of shared experience and really use that to better understand what they're going through. And one of the things we talked about at the beginning of the pandemic is just because we thought a certain thing about them then, it doesn't mean that's how it is today. And yeah, I think that's the idea of making sure that it's current. Final question for you, Stella, and then I'll let you get back onto to both of your jobs. This idea of if you had your time again, I don't mean this idea of regret, but it's if you look at it again, there might be steps that you'd skip or something like this. So was there anything you'd do differently, faster, better, or if you're speaking to someone who's earlier in their career, whether it be in sales or leadership, what are the two or three things you say that you should focus on immediately?
Yeah, look, I think, I don't have that many regrets. I tend to kind of look at, all of the, kind of positive opportunities I've had. But, you know, one thing, you know, if I looked at my former self, my young self, younger self, would be, you know, I wish I was a bit bolder, you know, in my youth. And, you know, I took a little bit more personal risk. I think, you know, I was kind of a, you know, very, you know, kind of very quiet and terrified analyst. You know, I was, you know, afraid of anything being, you know, wrong or, you know, and you know, any kind of error of any kind. And so, you know, I was hyper vigilant about that. But you know, what I didn't do a lot of was really speak up, you know, and so I wish I had, you know, been a little bit bolder to kind of put forward my opinions, even as a junior person. And so, you know, when I mentor people, you know, I do, you know, one of the concrete things I ask, you know, my mentees to do is in every meeting, you know, ask a question or two, or, you know, make a comment or two or an observation or two in every meeting that you're in. And, you know, I wish someone had, you know, kind of forced me into doing that when I was younger. And also, you know, building those relationships, you know, it's something that, you know, I've been doing over time, but I wish I did it more consciously as well, you know, in terms of building those networks, you know, maintaining those networks more strongly. It's something that I do much better job of now. But, you know, in those early years, you know, I just, you know, just loved making, you know, these relationships, but, you know, didn't really think about it in a kind of a conscious way. And so I wish I had done that as well a little bit more.
That idea of being bolder, and if maybe we put that back for everyone who's watching or listening on this idea, and I had a conversation with a colleague the other day, and they said something came out quite naturally, and I said it didn't 20 odd years ago when I was volunteering and when I was putting my hand up and practicing, and it's almost 20 years of doing it wrong before it becomes comfortable. And I think it's that idea of that 20 years starts from the day you start.
That's right.
So ask a question, be bold, role play, volunteer, put your hand up. Right. Because I haven't seen anyone who is worse off in their career because they volunteered for something or because they put their hand up. No good leader says, well, they made a mistake. They look at the volunteering and it's that intent more than anything else. And I think that idea of that, if we sort of focus on that, is a big thing for everyone. That second idea of being intentional with networking. I think we see that as we go forward, and I'm sure that there's clients you work with today that you worked with 5 years ago and 10 years ago and 15 years ago. And I certainly know myself of, you know, years of cold calling to now, it's networking, it's referrals, you know, there's an entire business that's there. And I'm sure that's the same with you, that when people change organizations, they take you with them to that organization. And that comes from continual adding value to them over time. And so I think those two things are, you know, if people only take those, be bold and be intentional with networking, I think that's a lot of value. We're going to let you go. Thank you so much for your time, Stella. Wanted to add or ask before we wrap up?
No, that's thank you so much for having me.
No, I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time flies through this, as it always does. But for those who are watching, thanks so much for joining us. And I'm going to quickly say, be bold and be intentional when it comes to networking. The words of Stella Cho. Thanks, Stella.
Thank you.